I've called my talk tonight, right, Self-Development. Some time ago, I was reading a book called The Heart of Fire by a gentleman called Kyriakos Markides. He's a Greek Cypriot, a naturalized American, but spends a lot of time in Cyprus. And he's a student of and friends with someone I think you'd probably describe as a mystic, to whom he gave the name Daskalos initially to preserve the gentleman's anonymity. He's written this book about the various activities and teachings of this man, and one of those activities is saving hungry ghosts from their fate. Now, what Buddhism calls a hungry ghost is a being who, because of some kind of extremely passionate craving and clinging, has got himself, or indeed herself, trapped after death in a state of clinging to something which should have been let go long since. Daskalos acts then as a helper to these hungry ghosts, trying to get them to see the error of their ways. And he tells the story of one man who, determined to become rich, spent most of his life in that endeavour, until at the age, actually quite young, of about 35, he amassed a very considerable fortune, at the cost, unfortunately, of his health. His health broke down, he became very ill. He became so ill that, in fact, he died, although he didn't know it. Now, you might ask, how can you not know it? But as far as he was concerned, he'd become extremely ill, and then, quite mysteriously, got better. And he found himself living in his palatial house, enjoying all the fruits of his very considerable wealth. He was a little puzzled how things seemed to happen, for meals appeared when no one seemed to be there to do anything about it, but at the same time wasn't sufficiently puzzled to worry about it unduly. Daskalos said that he would go on a fairly regular basis to see this individual in his self-created prison and try to reason with him, telling him that the food was only put there because he created it by mind, telling him that it wasn't just one or two days he'd been there, as he thought, but in fact 80 years, for time moves very much differently on that other level. Indeed, it seems as though one day for the hungry ghost is perhaps as much as 50 or 60 years of humankind's time. He needed to move on, but he was so attached to his wealth that he could not let it go. That story was never resolved. Many others were. It needn't be wealth that you're attached to, of course. You can get attached to almost anything. You can get attached to family, never moving on because you want to ensure that they're okay, always keeping tabs on everybody. It might be a particular individual, or a house, or you might get attached to something like drink, or bodily pleasures. You name it, it's possible to get attached to it. We are, in fact, all beings of love and light, but that light is so often obscured by the darkness of ignorance, craving, hatred and confusion. Self-development means to deal with those stains, ultimately to eradicate them completely. It means to get rid of them to the point where they never, ever return again. Self-development, then, is to remove the darkness of ignorant attachment, the cause of suffering, to allow the truth to shine through all our lives. There are many different paths leading to this freedom, but every single one of them rests upon the gradual and systematic eradication of self-importance. So we have the seeming paradox that self-development means to become less self-important. Self-importance, the attachment to ego gratification, is the very thing that has to go. many non-Buddhist ways of postulated higher and lower selves. In some cases, the higher self is taken to be that part of man which is identical with the absolute. It is said to be this self which we have to realize, and the so-called lower self, the egotistical one, that we have to overcome. When speaking in conventional terms, the Buddha often spoke of self. He said, for example, by the self, train the self. He said, by the self is evil done, by the self is evil left undone. And moreover, he said that each of us has not just one, but three selves, which I'll come to shortly. Of course, the Buddha also taught at the ultimate level that there is no permanent ego entity, no self, in any of the relative worlds, nor is there such an entity within the absolute. In fact, he taught that it is precisely the wrong views and subsequent attachments associated with self that have to be overcome before enlightenment, the end of all suffering, is possible. All effective ways to that freedom offer means to combat the major enemy to the spiritual path, self-importance, conceit, egocentricity. In some, notably the Christian ones, aspirants follow a life of poverty, chastity, and obedience. In the Hindu system, you might get bhakti, the development of devotion, or dharma, devotion to duty, your station in life, if you like. In others, rigorous self-discipline is the starting point. Yet other ways devote themselves to service through such things as teaching or caring for the sick and the dying. In most ways, prayer or meditation form an integral part. In all cases, the object is to reduce in importance the scope and intensity of your own wants and needs by putting others' welfare ahead of your own. In short, to reduce self-importance. In this, Buddhism is no different and includes some of the finest skillful means for bringing about a radical reduction in that very self-importance. So what about these three selves? The Buddha taught, and it finds almost identical expression in many other ways, that man has three bodies or selves. A physical body self, a mental body self, and a consciousness self. None of these is a permanent ego entity, nor is it the absolute, but all need to be trained, developed, for the fullest possible self-development. Very roughly, these three align with the Sila, Samadhi and Panya, the three major divisions of the Noble Eightfold Path. I want to look at the ways in which self-development is applied in each of these three cases, to each of these three selves. So I want to look at tonight how we can work on reducing self-importance, no matter which of the selves we have to be considering. So let's look at the physical body self first. The physical body self is the being within the gross material sphere, our normal world, our normal everyday self. It's the body, whether it be well, in good health, or ill and sick. It's the things that body believes it owns. It's the environment around it. Self-development for the physical body self here includes improving relationships with other people and with all things physical, whether personal or external. So it includes things like the way you look after yourself, your own body, and also how you treat other people. Let's look at that in a bit more detail. Personal well-being on the physical level is firstly a matter of health gained from food, shelter, and reasonable hygiene. Those things are obviously necessary. We see terrible pictures through the media these days about what happens when any of those are missing. I saw something really quite distressing the other evening on the television where Africans were boiling okra roots and stalks to form a sort of gruel, the only food they had. Something like, what is it, 8 or 9 million people at risk of starvation. So for physical health, clearly food is an essential, not to mention shelter and hygiene. But on the other hand, personal health is partly a matter of restraining excessive indulgence. Overdoing anything, eating, drinking, sleeping, or even working, weakens the mind and body by way of stress and anxieties of various kinds. For example, gross overeating produces a body which is extremely fat, difficult to move around, and puts an enormous strain upon things like the circulation, the breathing processes, and so on. Excessive drink, everybody knows the problem with, I think. Excessive sleep, less so, but it turns one into something of a vegetable, always seeking unconsciousness. Hardly the best situation for the physical body. The Greeks said that to have a sound mind, you need a sound body. The Buddha, too, recognized through his own experience that excesses, even in ascetic practices, damaged the body and so made the mind incapable of effective meditation. For example, there was a period when he lived on, so it is said, 1 grain of rice a day. Clearly not enough to sustain life, and indeed he found the flesh falling off so fast that when he grabbed hold of his stomach, he grabbed hold of his backbone. I guess you can't go much further than that. It weakens the mind as well, though, for mind is dependent upon the physical body. Another period he tried altering his breathing, tried to force control upon his body by stopping his breathing for as long as he could. He held his breath so long that his ears began to sing. He got shooting pains to his head and shooting pains to his stomach. Still he held his breath, and he said, and I quote, mindfulness was established thereby, I bet it was, but the body was not calmed. And he found that without a calm body, he couldn't do anything more. So he got bags of mindfulness and tremendous agitation. So that wasn't the way through either. And as you all know, I'm sure, in the end he abandoned the extreme ascetic practices as being utterly useless for the purpose of true self-development. Personal well-being also, of course, is a matter of the way in which we relate to other people. And that is a very fertile field for reducing self-importance. Reducing self-importance when relating to others is largely a matter of restraining selfish physical behavior, killing, stealing, wrongful sexual behavior, harmful talk, and intoxication. Those, of course, are the 5 precepts. And such restraint of selfish activity brings about a state of relative calmness in mind and body, and thus eliminates what are called the 5 guilty dreads, a term I think is particularly evocative. What are these 5 guilty dreads? Well, they're basically fear and anxiety about being found out. And you can see how that might apply to killing, to stealing, and to wrongful sexual behavior. As for killing, I saw the other day how they had solved a murder, forensic science had solved a murder something like 8 years old by careful reconstruction of the skeleton and laying, determining how much flesh there was on the bones and so on and so forth. I'm sure the murderer must have thought that he got away with it after 8 years, but I wonder if he still suffered from guilty dread. I would think so. Stealing. One's always in danger of being found out. That dreadful anxiety about being caught is exactly the guilty dread we're talking about. What about things like wrong speech, though? People, I think, find that one very difficult sometimes. If you go around using wrong kinds of speech, harsh speech, slanderous speech, telling tales out of school, defaming other people behind their backs, spreading gossip and rumor. There is a guilty dread associated with that, which you may not immediately have thought of. There is, in fact, what arises is a fear and anxiety of being misrepresented, slandered, or libeled. In other words, if you yourself tear other people's reputations to bits, you will develop a fear of people doing the same for you. And that guilty dread is really quite an unpleasant one to live with. Intoxication, on the other hand, has a slightly different guilty dread associated with it. You begin to develop a fear and anxiety about one's personal reputation. Begin to develop a fear and anxiety about losing control, about performing degrading actions, about losing your hold on reality. I remember once talking to a man who drank an enormous amount on a regular basis. He'd had his license taken away twice, and he was driving a car, even though he shouldn't. He'd been to the pub. He told me something which was quite extraordinary. I don't know whether to believe it or not, but a huge amount of drink. And then he said he came to, and he found that he couldn't work out what was happening. His neck was all bent, and he didn't seem to be able to find any purchase with his feet. It transpired that he was in the gents of the pub to which he'd been, and somehow he'd fallen, and he'd got his legs up in the air and was standing on his shoulders and didn't know which way up he was, literally. After that, he got in the car and drove home. It's really rather sad when you think about it. So the guilty dreads, he was constantly in fear of being caught by the police driving, as you might imagine, not to mention all the other things. Those guilty dreads can be allayed by ensuring that there's a certain amount of restraint of selfish activities. And I think you can see, too, that it makes you very much safer to be around. So it is caring for others in a very real way. There's also a worry about the future, about the fear of consequences in a future life. If you hold with the idea of rebirth, then, and indeed with the fact that actions have results, then it follows that if you perform a lot of questionable actions in this life, you stand a chance of being reborn in slightly dodgy circumstances next time round. And the fear of that can be another kind of guilty dread attendant upon extreme selfish behaviour. So there's quite a lot of self-development that can be done on the purely physical level, much of which is to do with restraint. What about the mental body self, though? How does that fit in? Well, with the five guilty dreads banished and a reasonably healthy lifestyle, the way is then clear for the development of that mental body self, the self in the psychic or emotional sphere. Indeed, this could truly be called the control and management of desires and emotions. Whenever we get something we don't want, pain for instance, we tend to get agitated and or depressed. Whenever we manage to get what we desperately do want, like calmness in the meditation, for example, we may get so elated that we can't continue. We have to learn balance before we can go on. And there are many techniques and practices available within the Buddhist training which assist greatly in this further reduction of self-importance. For if we get extremely depressed, that's only possible because we are so attached to our own progress. So there's a huge amount of self-importance there. If, on the other hand, we get extremely elated, haven't we done well? Again, it says the same thing. There's a great deal of self-importance underlying that elation, and that needs to be moderated. For instance, take the meditation as an example. Emotional development in this sphere is really critical for all meditators once beyond the beginning stages. The stage I'm talking about is in fact given a special name. It's called overcoming elation and dejection. If we don't master those two, then no further progress is possible. It works like this. We start out, we spend hours, days, weeks and months perhaps practicing our meditation exercises, studying maybe, learning about the teaching and religiously doing the best we can. The first week or so is probably not too bad. We don't expect to get it all at once, even though we'd like to. But then, as the weeks go by, we begin to get sorely tried because perhaps we're not seeing the kind of results we wanted. And we begin to fall into dejection. We begin to get depressed. We begin to champ at the bit. And gradually, we develop some rather unlovely characteristics which makes certain that we can't move on any further. Sometimes, and it is only sometimes, it gets so bad that we give up, totally give up in despair in the meditation itself. If you do that, if you really do give up, then all of a sudden all of the problems fall away, it goes peaceful, still, calm, and really quite wonderful. But of course, you can't do it by expecting to do it. That's the trouble. You really have to let go for real. You can't say, well, I'll let go of this pain if I get calm. You can't sort of bargain with it, unfortunately. On the other hand, of course, it may be that you've been working away steadily, doing everything right, no particular problems apart from the usual ones, and then it does all of a sudden go very still and calm, very mindful, very clear. And it lasts for about half a second, and you're over the moon. Tremendous rush of excitement and agitation. So much so that it's impossible to get back to it in the next hour, or the next day, or even the next week, because you're trying so hard to re-establish that momentary success. And gradually the lessons do dawn that until that elation is restrained, until that dejection is restrained, you're always going to get tripped up at around that point. So progress needs a self-possessed, critical eye. Otherwise, you find those problems are virtually insuperable. But there are quite definite steps you can take to aid you in this emotional balancing act. It's not just a matter of how you do your meditation moment to moment. You can undertake specific practices which begin to assist in this regard. The four Brahmaviharas, divine abiding so-called, are extremely useful in this regard, especially loving-kindness, meditation and compassion. Loving-kindness, for example, is a meditation where you develop friendliness for yourself and for all beings in the entire universe, in all the three worlds. It's designed in part to overcome the barriers between people, to eradicate fear, and to generate goodwill not only in oneself but in those around you. It involves developing friendliness not only for beings, but also for the creations of your own mind, including spectres of failure and spectres of success. So what does it mean to overcome the barriers? It's quite a difficult concept, I think, to get across initially, but one way that seems to work is this. Imagine you're in an aircraft, just four or five of you passengers, and it's hijacked. The hijackers group the five of you together. There's an old person, there's a baby, couple in their middle years and you, and they say they want one of you, and they're going to kill you. And you, poor you, have been lumbered with making the choice. Who's it to be? How do you choose? Do you choose? If you've truly overcome the barriers, do you say, do what appears to be the right thing and offer yourself? And the answer is a categorical no, you do not. For that means you still have a partiality one way or the other. The only right answer, if we can talk indeed of a right answer at all, is that there is no choice to make. You see all beings as equal, you see no divisions. Overcoming the barriers is not only between human beings, but between all beings. And it's an extremely powerful thing when it happens. So practicing this loving kindness meditation generates a stability of mind which is extremely difficult to overthrow. And that stability of mind is of extreme help when it comes to passing that stage of elation and dejection in the meditation practice. As with all mental developments, there are some problems to overcome with it. The enemies of loving-kindness meditation are sensual desire on the one hand and ill will on the other. Sensual desire is called the near enemy because it has a somewhat similar flavor. And there are many stories about how much of a problem this is, and I think you might be able to see for yourself. If I say that sensual desire is wanting to see, to touch, to be with the individual towards whom you're practicing this loving-kindness meditation. So it emphasizes the physical body instead of emotional control. And in the books, there's a rather lovely story of a man who was sleeping in the next room to his wife, decided to do this loving-kindness meditation towards her, and in the words of the discourse, spent the night beating against the wall, trying to get through it. So in other words, all he did was arouse sensual desire and not friendliness in the sense that loving-kindness means at all. Ill will, on the other hand, the far enemy, so-called, is getting annoyed and breeding resentment. And you can see how that might happen. You're trying to practice generating friendly feelings towards someone whom you believe has done you wrong. And before you know it, you're thinking, yes, but, you know, you really did do that. And I don't know that I can ever forgive him for that. And off you go. And before long, you've built a nice, well, not a nice, a really rather unpleasant miasma of hatred in the mind. And so you could be said to be practicing unfriendliness instead. It's surprisingly easily done if you're not careful. So again, the perfect development of loving-kindness meditation means that you learn how to restrain those aspects of emotional behavior. And it strengthens you further. Compassion, on the other hand, is learning not just to like others, but also to wish to help them, to aid them in some fashion. Great care has again to be taken to avoid the enemies of compassion, which are self-pity on the one hand and cruelty on the other. For example, practicing compassion, you can do it in so many different ways. It can be done as a pure meditation, but it can also be done in a very practical way. One of the most intensely practical is through service, and that means physical service. The devotion to and care of others all help to develop the mental body in the way of reducing self-importance. And think of the myriad ways there are that service is part of life. Bringing up a family demands intense service. It doesn't have to be something as obvious as running a soup kitchen. It could be even making a cup of tea for a colleague. All of these things are service. Caring for the sick, teaching, many, many more. All of these things can be done in a spirit of service, where the other person's welfare is put ahead of your own. But self-pity can be a real enemy in that situation. How many mothers have felt martyred from time to time? They'll do everything they can for the family, but they secretly think, they just don't know how much I suffer. Here I go, carry on day after day, never give a thought to myself. And there's a very strong element of self-pity creeps in from time to time. That martyrdom is not then making the best use of the service which is compassion, the compassion which is service, for it corrupts it in a selfish way. The far enemy, cruelty, is perhaps more, is easier to see, it's more prevalent in some areas. It's doing good, as it were, but enjoying at the same time causing pain. It's the schoolmaster who enjoys breaking rulers over little boys' hands. It's the civil servant who is anything but civil. It's the nurse who sometimes gets a perverse pleasure out of giving an injection in the most painful way possible, especially to an annoying patient. Cruelty can creep in even through the best intentions, especially if you're overworked, underpaid, and life's getting on top of you. All of the good intentions for compassion can be subverted so easily. Again, therefore, the proper development of compassion is a wonderful training and development of emotional control, the self-development of this emotional and mental body self. That aspect of cruelty, incidentally, also operates when good works are done from a position of assumed superiority. And if you've been in the situation, you'll find there's nothing worse than being done good to by someone using you as an exercise to practice charity. But what about psychic development as opposed to just simple emotional development? Well, when developing awareness of the actual mental body, emotional control is very much also needed. So-called astral travel in the mental body, for instance, needs impeccable emotional management. Without such control, the aspiring mental traveler will meet strange situations and react with floods of anxious emotion. This completely destroys the balance for the time being, and the traveler's journey is abruptly terminated by return to the gross physical body. The development of the capacity to be conscious in the mental body is accomplished partly by visualization and partly by the control of emotional responses. And this means further reducing self-importance by learning to control and to make little of one's own selfish desires. In this context, imagination can be a tremendous problem. And to try and give you a taste of what I'm talking about, by taking a fairly mundane example, say you are walking alone in the woods at night. How do you respond? Do you see a lurker behind every tree, or do you never give it a thought? If you are someone who sees shadows come to life with alarming rapidity, then it suggests that your emotional control could use some work. Well, let alone walking through woods. What about walking to an isolated car park when it's dark, having to go through the shadowy parts? How do you react? If you've got a strong imagination that isn't controlled, you can have some interesting times. So it is with the person who is attempting to learn how to become conscious in the mental body. If imagination runs away, then nothing much can be achieved except a lot of fright. One way to effective development in the psychic sphere rests upon, again, service to other people, but in this case on a mental level rather than on a physical one. Again, loving-kindness meditation and compassion meditation can be used in this context. One way of practicing loving-kindness meditation is to imagine yourself going on, as it were, a walkabout, to visualize yourself actually going to see the individual towards whom you're intending to practice the loving-kindness. That means you try and visualize yourself, if not making the entire journey, certainly arriving at the house where they are and seeking them out and trying to visualize them in that place. Some surprising things can come from that. And going back to what I was talking about before, in this, the various things that Daskalos, this Cypriot mystic, does, he goes out to assist at deathbeds. It's said when a person is dying that very often relatives, deceased relatives, gather and help that person's transition from one life to the next. Well, not only do the relatives go there, but also there are trained helpers who do that, as it were, from this side. Daskalos is one such. So there can be help and assistance given at that level. Sometimes when people die suddenly, for example, a soldier in battle, they may not know that they've been killed. If ever you've suffered an accident of some kind involving a sharp cut or blow, you'll know that it doesn't actually hurt at the time. The pain comes later. It can be really quite a severe injury, but all you feel is a blow which might move you, might even knock you down. And you don't even realize you've been particularly hurt until later. Well, if that blow is fatal, you know it even less because you pick yourself up, leaving the physical body lying there, and you wander off in your mental body. Now, that's not a terribly useful state of affairs because it helps to know what's going on. And usually you will find that in such situations there are trained helpers again who assist those newly departed to find their mental feet, as it were, and point out to them the realities of their situation. Again, developing emotional control, developing the capacity to assist others and minimize one's own self-importance. Someone I know well, some time ago, spent some time in a cottage in the heart of the country. And in doing his nightly walkabout, his loving-kindness meditation, suddenly found himself grappling with a figure in one part of the house. Somewhat taken aback, he inquired what was going on, and this figure, apparently a cowled man, was most irate that there should be intruders in his house. When being informed he was dead, he didn't believe it. And so he was asked what date it was. And he said, 1760. And this friend said, "Have I got news for you?" And told him the date, the year. And said again that this individual was dead, that he was hanging on to his house and should let it go, should move on. Well, it must have got through because the figure disappeared and there was no more disturbance at all. But that figure clearly thought it had been a matter of days. To still believe the date to be 1760, when in fact it's over 200 years later, shows you how differently time passes. And because such individuals, such hungry ghosts, haven't learned emotional management, haven't learned self-development in the mental sphere, that they are trapped until someone can assist them. So developing emotional control, developing the capacity perhaps to even travel in the mental body and assist others is all part of self-development. Not done for the glory of it, for indeed it's a lot of hard work and often not very rewarding in the sense of ego boosting, usually quite the reverse in fact, but it does lead towards increasing freedom. What about the consciousness self? Well, this, as its name suggests, is development within the sphere of consciousness itself. It includes both awareness of the refined, concentrated levels of mind and actual recognition through experience of what the Buddha's teaching labels right view and right thought. View structure is particularly important, and it's how you see your world, how things fit together. And this is adjusted and corrected by study and experience gained from life itself, whether following this teaching or not. Experience will show, for example, that stealing leads almost inexorably to suffering. Wrong view, believing, for example, there's no point in ethical action, and wrong thought, assuming that self-gratification is the only measure of success, leads to increasing self-importance and distress. Whereas right view, the idea that actions do have results, that for every unselfish action we do, we reap a positive, beneficial reward, as it were. Not a reward, but a resultant. And for every inefficient action we do, every selfish action, we reap suffering. Right view, in that way, can be transformative for the individual who adopts it. Right thought is thought free from selfishness, thought free from craving, and thought free from hatred. If you eliminate, even temporarily, craving and hatred, it's clear that at that time there is no self-importance in the mind. For when you examine the whole thing closely, you find that self-importance is craving and hatred. So the whole thing begins to make more sense. So in essence, we're talking about the restraint of selfishness. It leads to extreme peace of mind and what I call mental cleanliness. It leads to a great deal of personal ease and satisfaction. It's also possible to develop the consciousness self in a really practical way also, through meditation, through becoming conscious at levels beyond those concerned with materiality. It's a very difficult subject to talk about, so I don't propose to go into detail on that anymore this evening. All I will say is that there are tremendous advantages to self-development through reducing self-importance, and a few of them are these. Upwelling of spontaneous joy, spontaneous loving kindness filling the mind from time to time, a constant acceptance of people and things as they are, without wishing to change them in some way. A reduction in criticism, in worry, in anxiety and fear. A sound knowledge of right action. Of knowing what really helps others. A knowledge of what really helps oneself. Also, the experiencing of help from other people, quite spontaneously, and perhaps when you least expect it. All of those are advantages that accrue from reducing self-importance. Further, there's an assurance of a good destiny. You know that you'll be reborn into better circumstances than previously. You develop a trust in life, feeling that everything works out for the best in the long run. you gain an increasing knowledge of kamma and vipaka, action and result, and a greater freedom to experience life as it is. You experience a reduction in attachment and a reduction in distress. We even begin to see that so-called disasters always, and I do mean always, have a silver lining. There's no such thing as something which is wholly bad. Self-development, as described so far, will ensure increasingly pleasant conditions in which to live, whether here and now or in a future life. But there is more. Self-development, as described so far, is not the end of the road. The final goal is complete transcendence of all relative phenomena in the three worlds, going beyond all formations and all expressions, going beyond all self, takes up a path like this. It's to reach the high point of human evolution. It's what we're all aiming at, whether we know it or not. It's the culmination of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it's to be truly self-developed, with absolutely no self-importance left. And that's what it means to become a true adept at reducing self-importance. Thank you.